under the Non-Intercourse Act, although the Interior Department says the Non-Intercourse Act doesn't apply to ANCSA lands. Or finally, you get to the point of sovereign immunity. And if the tribe owns the land, then the IRA says that the tribe cannot be dispossessed of the land without its consent. And so that, if there is inherent sovereign immunity in the first place, and the IRA puts a statutory confirmation on that. So, I mean, you have several levels and sort of backup positions that, in my mind, just seem to arise with the interaction of this federal legislation and the basic doctrines of Indian law.
Mr. Lerner, just before I call on you, the discussion has been wide-ranging from cosmic considerations to very specific considerations, and I think that enhances the discussion. I wonder if all of those who are legally trained around the table, for the sake of the record of this proceeding, because a typist will take the audio and type it up, I wonder if, when you have a moment this morning, you just write out on a piece of paper the names of the cases you cited that you can remember, and we can just hand the list to the typist so that she will be able to reproduce those case names without embarrassment, if I may put it in that way. The other, perhaps I just might add something that that bears on what will be happening next week at these meetings. One of the members of the media handed me a note. As you know, in Canada this week, the Prime Minister and the Premiers of the provinces are holding a constitutionally mandated meeting with the native leaders of Canada, and that meeting is held in public and is televised to the whole nation. And I'm told that Prime Minister Trudeau yesterday proposed an amendment to the Constitution of Canada to entrench Aboriginal rights, including provisions for native self-government, native languages, and native education rights. To have a constitutional amendment accepted in Canada, 7 out of 10 provinces must agree, and of the 7 provinces, one or other must be Ontario or Quebec. Those are 2 very large provinces, each with 1/3 of the population of the country. And according to this note, Ontario, which is one of the provinces whose agreement is essential, and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia supported the proposal. 7 others argued against it and said they were opposed to it. That's an interesting development because in 1969, Prime Minister Trudeau, in a famous public statement, made it clear that he would never recognize Aboriginal rights, that the rights of the native peoples of Canada were to be regarded as no different from the rights of other Canadians, and that their claims, as he put it, could only be satisfied as citizens of Canada in the same way that the claims of other citizens of Canada to education, health, housing, and a good life could be achieved. I suppose this illustrates that much is happening in other places besides Alaska, and when the Canadian Native leaders arrive here next week, it will be very interesting to see how that proposal was greeted. It says here that one of the Native leaders said it was a grand gesture. Well, no doubt it was. May I say this about next week, that we will start on, we won't start on Tuesday morning, but we will start Tuesday afternoon at 1:15. That's when the third and last session of the overview will be completed, Tuesday at 1:15, and apart from David Case and Rosita Worrell and myself, who it is to be hoped that we provide some continuity from one session to the next, Browning Pipestem will be here from the Lower 48, and I hope one or two others who will introduce an Alaskan flavor to the proceedings. I think that, Mr. Lerner, you were next on my list. Interesting.
I had a question from Mr. Case, but the briefest comment on your observation about Mr. Trudeau. Either he has reached a different understanding of the matter, or he is acting on his publicly proclaimed decision not to seek elective office again in Canada.
Or both,
right. I think that will be probably an exhaustive classification. Mr. Case, if I heard you correctly, you were saying that an IRA government could not be deprived of its lands without its consent. If that's, if the language has that kind of definiteness, that would be a greater protection than ordinary citizens would enjoy under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution.
Right. It doesn't probably run against the United States government.
Whom does it run against?
Anybody else.
The state couldn't exercise some eminent domain
Right. States cannot condemn tribal property. That's a general rule. States can condemn individual Indian property that's held in trust or restricted status. There's a statute to that effect. But tribal property is not subject to state condemnation or any other involuntary loss from judgment or otherwise.
But from the standpoint of a non-native Alaskan, then, this would be a protection that he or she might very well envy.
Well, yes, but yes, that's true. It is a protection that is part of the fabric of federal Indian law as it applies to tribes. And that is perhaps an anomaly in a constitutional system that focuses on individual rights.
Yeah.
But there is, in fact, in my view, and I think Ralph Johnson mentioned this before, a separate history and with respect to Native American status that is very much a mixed bag. But it is essentially, I think, it's fair to say, a legal status that is, for good or ill, outside of the U.S. Constitution. And that it is true that Native American tribes, as communities or groups, whichever or whatever term, not necessarily limited to those you prefer to use, it is a status that the Native American communities have. The Bill of Rights does not even now apply in total to Native American communities, and it applies theoretically, in part, through an act of Congress, but even that act has a very limited remedy. In other words, tribes are not subject to federal court jurisdiction to enforce the Bill of Rights or any of the rights protected under the Bill of Rights, with the exception of habeas corpus. So these rights are true, they are the rights of a community, not the rights of an individual. It is the community that has the right to prevent, as a political sovereign or a political community, the loss of its assets without its consent.
A follow-up to that, if I may. So, insofar as one is thinking about the problem in the terms of ANCSA, not conjuring up an entire new world, one objective that Native peoples might have would be to see how they can combine the advantages of this special protection within the framework of a law, of this communal or collective protection, or the protection that communal or collective organization gives them, within the framework of a law that pretty much mandates individual title.
Right, I guess that's one way of putting it. And that seems to be one of the approaches that has been suggested, and that is indeed the point of attempting to, as the one of the AFN resolutions has suggested, retribalize the ANCSA lands or some portion of them.
But when you say retribalize, that carries with it, to my untutored ear, an effort to recur to earlier forms, and the history of the interactions in white man's law between those earlier forms and government have been so mixed, so disappointing, so mutable, mm-hmm. that it would seem that one wouldn't want to travel that route yet again. I mean, that someone spoke in an earlier meeting of the swinging of the pendulum, mm-hmm. blowing hot and cold. And to that extent, I was wondering whether the language, whether the language isn't in a way locking you into a repetition of something that probably most people don't want to relive.
Well, and I think that points out in my mind the very importance of people, native people in particular, at the grassroots that are affected by these questions, of understanding the pros and the cons. I mean, there is the risk of which you speak. I mean, there are disadvantages in being outside of the Constitution, and there are advantages, I guess, is one point that could be made. And there are both. And it is not entirely clear that by jettisoning that status, you not only eliminate the advantages along with the disadvantages. I mean, it's important to understand the relative risks and benefits both forms, or if you will, or of the institute of relatively being under the Constitution or relatively being outside of the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, I guess that was the thing that had struck me in these earlier sessions. The human desire to have one's cake and eat it too, but that is to say, to have the immunities that attend special status, mm-hmm. special treatment under the law, and yet to have all the benefits that come from being under the law, money. Mm-hmm. And the protection from the one side and the money that comes from the other. And given the utterly unpredictable and checkered character of Indian relations under law, this special American Indian law, mm-hmm. One might wonder whether some of those, or the most important of those advantages that come from collective and cooperative joining together, might not be secured in some inventive way under the regular law. It's a question. I'm very far from having an answer, to which I'm trying to tug people along. I'm just wondering about it.
I don't know that. I mean, I'm sure it's not my place to even. And I don't have an answer to that question. One must be leery of doing new things. I think that's it's a wise caution. I mean, new things are fine. except that you don't know what they're going to do. And I don't share, I guess, the feeling that the law in, with respect to Native Americans is completely or terribly unpredictable. It does swing back and forth, but I think a very good point could be made that it has stopped swinging, that there is now a policy that is pretty well entrenched that focuses on self-determination. We have to watch that very carefully, because you have to watch that the pendulum doesn't start to swing, but there's about 20 pieces of legislation enacted since 1971 that in many ways entrench that philosophy, if not in the Constitution, at least in the law. And so I'm not so sure that the pendulum is in danger of swinging back the other way, and that is quite as great a concern as it has been in the past. And I'm not so sure that the law is so unpredictable. Finally, I just don't want to go on here, but one other point, just thought. It occurred to me as Daly was talking about the need for clarity and in the law and in resolving these jurisdictional questions, it may well be that there is an advantage in not resolving them. And that is that as long as they are unclear, there is freedom to act, and that there is always the risk that in attempting to clarify things, they will get clarified in a way that is not advantageous to whatever interest it is that you happen to support. So it's perhaps important to be well aware of the political realities when one is attempting to clarify issues, or if one is attempting to develop new institutions. I mean, the risk in developing new institutions is that you won't be in control, really, of the design of them. And then that compounds the problem of not being aware of how they're going to act once they're put in place.
That is a provocative remark. Ted Chamberlain and then Sheldon Kachetag and then Ralph Johnson. Might I offer an observation that this pendulum that swings, as far as Native people are concerned, doesn't appear to swing in response to the currents of conventional American politics. That is, it seems to me interesting that in a sense the last high watermark for acknowledgement of Native people's distinct place in the U.S. scheme of things occurred in the early years of the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and certainly President Reagan's statement on Native sovereignty January last year. It goes beyond anything that was, I think, explicitly acknowledged by President Roosevelt. Those two presidents are thought of as being at opposite ends of the conventional political spectrum, and yet both happen to be in office when the pendulum was swinging in the same way. Perhaps that's a naive and simplistic observation, but Ted Chamberlain, and then we'll carry on from there.
I just wanted to pick up on the reference, the use of the word anomalous to describe the relations with Indian groups in the United States. That's a word that's been used since the 18th century, and indeed one which was routinely celebrated as describing the character of the Indian nations. Lewis Cass used it. Senator Dawes and others tried their best to remove the anomaly, and it wasn't until the New Deal legislation that there was a determined effort to acknowledge that anomalous character, to embrace it, to in some sense enhance it. It is, and has always been, as much a part of a distinctly American, and before that a distinctly British tradition, and there's absolutely no reason to see things otherwise. In 1914, Frederick Abbott, who was at the time the secretary of the Board of Indian Commissioners, which is a religious group set up by Grant under his peace policy after the Civil War, Abbott was instructed to do a review of Canadian Indian administration, came to Canada, wrote a report, and in the course of that, he spent a lot of time with Duncan Campbell Scott, who had recently taken over as Deputy Superintendent General, and Scott became, over the next 20 years, the single figure who pronounced on Canadian Indian policy. In his report, Abbott described Scott's, or recounted Scott's, description of Canadian Indian policy, and the phrasing that Scott had used was that Canadian Indian policy was founded on what he described as the radical principle of maintaining the Indian community attached to the land while leaving individuals free to pursue their livelihood far and wide on or off the land. Abbott strongly endorsed that principle, said it was a principle which should be returned to front and center of American Indian administration, and it was in some measure that principle which was picked up by the Merriam commissioners in their report. They phrased it in familiar terms, in terms of the complementary principles of protection and advancement, which was phrasing which was used through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, very much as a kind of stock and trade phrase by American and Canadian administrators, a phrase which certainly highlighted the difficult decisions that had to be reached in balancing those two obligations, those two responsibilities for protection and advancement, but also highlighted the anomalous character of the legislation that was being passed and of the position of the Indian nations. And it seems to me that the thing that has to be kept in mind is that there is nothing inconsistent or discontinuous about searching for ways to reestablish that anomalous character in Alaska. It seems to me that ANCSA has eliminated many of the anomalies, and there is much to be said for bringing them back, perhaps in different forms, perhaps through IRA, perhaps in various other ways, but certainly in ways that focus on the blunt fact that there is nothing like the Indian nations in the United States. There is nothing comparable. There are no rights that are comparable to the rights that have traditionally been acknowledged, not always respected, but acknowledged as belonging to belonging to the Indian people. And I think that the difficulty of finding ways of sustaining those rights and enhancing them emphasizes the importance, which has certainly been referred to a number of times here, of returning to the villages, to the elders, to the people themselves, to try to draw from there the principles that will inform the legislation that will protect those rights and those interests. And I mention that for a particular reason, because there are a distinct range of issues that have, in recent years, been brought to bear on land claims. There are three kinds of ways in which land claims have been presented. They've been presented in some cases on the basis of traditional rights, which often, usually, go back to what are recounted as pre-contact activities. They're often captured in a notion of aboriginal rights, and they usually, to some degree or other, inform all land claims. But there have also been land claims which have taken, which have focused on a different aspect. They've focused on post-contact activities, on historical rights, on rights which are often constitutional rights or rights which have become accepted through administrative practice or whatever. And then there's a third group which are no less important for many of the claims, and those are the current needs of the people, contemporary needs and future needs. And certainly, and I'm sure you'll hear much more about this by people who know much more than I do next week, but certainly in Australia right now, you can see all three kinds of claims being presented. On all three bases, on the basis of traditional pre-contact aboriginal rights in the Northern Territories, on the basis of historical practice and historical rights in Queensland, and on the basis of contemporary needs in New South Wales. And I think all of those have to come together in the perception of the people who are most concerned, the people in the communities, and have to come together from a perception of both the young and the old, both the people who have a sense of their own immediate and future needs, and the people who have a sense of their past traditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. Sheldon Ketchetag, you wanted to add something.
Yes, my name is Sheldon Ketchetag. I'm the Vice Chairman of the United Tribes of Alaska, but at the present time I'm speaking strictly as a person who is vitally concerned with all the issues which you have been discussing here for the last 2 weeks. A point that I'd like to bring up is the fact that the IRA governments were set up as political governments. But we also have the right, as political governments, to have a requirement for a certain minimum blood quantum for membership. Why is that? Okay, first of all, it recognizes that we, as a culture, are separate and distinct from the Western culture of the United States of America. It also provides a political vehicle through which we can protect our separate and distinct cultures. And one other thing which has not been brought out since I've been here, and please excuse me for not being here during this the whole time, political power is inherent from and derived through the will of the people. And at the time when the IRA Act was applied to the Native people of Alaska, those people were all Natives, so that there was no question of discrimination or protectionism or exclusivism, because they were all Native. And one of the things about the IRA Act, which I think has proven to be a detriment to the people, the Native people of Alaska, is the fact that through the IRA Act, we were reassured that the federal government would look out for all of our interests. And that is shown in the part of the IRA Act which says that no lands, interest in lands, can be sold, leased, encumbered in any way without the consent of the tribe. Now that, to my way of thinking, says that the great United States government says we are holding everything that you hold dear in trust, which includes all of the lands which we have used and occupy, which are many times greater than the land that we have received under the Claim Settlement Act. somewhere along the line, there has been a transition on the federal government's part in their role from keepers of this trust to that majority government from which we now must claim those interests which they say they have been holding in trust. And also, I believe that we have a political right, since political power is inherent and also derived from the will of the people, that in order to protect and promote our various and diverse cultures, we have a mechanism available to us to do this. Otherwise, you can see very easily that we are in the process of being assimilated. And that is not the wish of the people. The man in the village does not identify with the corporations. And that presents a very serious problem when you consider that everything that they have gained under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, they don't identify with. They seem to think that the corporations will have their day and they'll be gone. But what they don't realize is the fact that what will go with them is, first of all, the land base and all the renewable resources upon which our various and diverse cultures are based. Because our culture is not based on beef, it's not based on corn, it's based on those resources which have gotten us from primitive times to where we are today. And even now, in this very modern age, we still derive approximately 70% of the food we need from the land and not from the supermarket. And I believe that one of the things which I think everybody who is a member of the Western society should begin to think about is the idea of cultural equality. We as a culture have a right, and also we believe we should be respected as a culture. We are not to be assimilated solely because that great government in Washington, D.C. says that is to be their policy. Even if the Congress decides through an act, that there will be no more IRA governments, there will still be tribal governments, because that is the will of the people. Another problem that we have is the fact that the majority of our languages have not had a written component in them. We have always had historical boundaries between our various and diverse settlements. These boundaries were abided by these neighboring villages. And yet, because they were unwritten and oral, however old they may have been, they were not respected or even considered by the great influx of the Western society. And I really have problems with ANCSA because of that clause of the IRA Act which says that you the Secretary of the Interior can do nothing with any of our lands, interest in lands, water rights, surface rights, you name it, without the consent of the tribe. And to my way of thinking, that's what ANCSA is. It's an act that has been passed and imposed upon us from the outside world without the consent of the tribe. And that is, I think, is one of the main reasons why your man in the village does not identify with the corporations, even though everything about him and his life and his lifestyle is potentially tied up in those corporations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kachetak. Mr. Johnson?
Yes,
I'd like to simply expand on what Sheldon Kochtag has said, that in the many years of experience that I've been working with the tribes in the lower 48, and not just with radical members or whatever, but with the heart and core of the people, tribal judges, tribal leaders from around the country, one thing is clear, and that is they don't want to eliminate the even the confused powers of government they have. It may look anomalous and confusing to some of us outside, but when the question comes up, well, let's clean this up, let's fix this up, and you'll just be like a county, it's a neat, clean system, there's a very clear answer, and that is no. Two major attempts have been tried to do, have been tried, let's assume it was by people of good meaning in Dawes, a Christian man in the 1870s who thought that it was best for the Indians. My understanding is that he thought it was best for the Indians. And a lot of other people may have had other ideas, but some of the sponsors of that act thought it was good for the Indians to assimilate and to put them onto tracts of land, and they would then assimilate into the great melting pot. By 1934, it was apparent that that was a failure. If the goal was to make the Indian life better, it was a total and abject failure. It simply worsened the lives of the Indians all over the country. In Public Law 280 and in the specific terminations of the 1950s, the same thing was tried. That is, we shouldn't have these rural ghettos. The Indians are the worst, the poorest, the most diseased people in the country. And the way to resolve that question is to bring them into the state governments. That didn't happen. In fact, the Menominee and the Klamath tribes that were terminated, their lives became much worse. We've heard Ada Deer much more personally on that, and the other tribes that have been terminated, so that they became a universal recognition, not just Indianophiles or somebody over there, but the universal recognition that the Indian's life was worse because of Public Law 280 and because of the specific termination acts that occurred during that time. What I'm saying is that it may be confused questions of jurisdiction, there may be anomalies, but if you ask the Indian community what the answer is, their answer is very clear, and that is we prefer to have such powers of self-government as we can. I'd like to leave one other notion in mind, and that is, two ideas, and that is that their sophistication in the exercise of their government has been increasing by tremendous leaps and bounds since 1950, 1960, in that era. It's training, ability to deal with the outside world and with their own problems has been increasing very rapidly. There's one other idea, though, that it seems to me we want to have woven in here, and that is the de facto exercise of jurisdiction that the IRA governments and tribal governments in the United States have been exercising are sometimes best handled in a situation of concurrent jurisdiction. If you have either state jurisdiction or tribal jurisdiction, you frequently get into exceptionally difficult and complicated legal questions. Whereas when you have, frequently you have a concurrent jurisdiction, if it's not it's a matter that's very important to the tribe, then they exercise jurisdiction. If it's a matter that is very important to the state, then the state exercises jurisdiction. In most cases on Indian tribes in the lower 48, where that jurisdiction has been exercised by the tribes, the state stays out of it, as they should. And so one possibility for consideration for handling some of the problems in Alaska may be to look at the question of concurrent jurisdiction and let a de facto situation arise where if the natives here wish to exercise jurisdiction and go ahead and do it, that's the way it would be done.
Ada Deer.
I'd like to respond to some of what Daly has brought up in terms of the vision and the sense of justice. In our treaties, we ceded away millions of acres of land to the federal government, and if I recall correctly, something like 9.5 million acres of land were ceded over. And the agreement was that the Menominees would have their reservation to be held as a homeland for the Menominees, as Indian lands are held. We interpreted this to mean forever, not at the whim of Congress. And when we started doing a background work and trying to understand the termination and so on, this was, you know, brought out, and we looked at our treaties. Now I realize that you don't have treaties up here, but the point here is, you know, what is just? And we rejected the plenary power of Congress in passing this Termination Act. And in the passage of the Restoration Act, we were successful in getting all the major provisions that we wanted. As a matter of fact, our powers of tribal sovereignty are enhanced, and it's too long to go into here, but I would like to suggest that the commission invite members of the county government here, the tribal legislature, and others that have been connected, or perhaps Mr. Berger could, or some staff person could make a visit to Menominee County. At any rate, I want to make a suggestion that a more comprehensive study be done of the Menominee situation for the purposes of ANSCA here, because we don't have the time and I don't have all the information that you all require to have a complete understanding of this. In terms of social engineering, many of the people that do this, and I've mentioned this earlier, but I want to emphasize this again, they have gone on to bigger jobs, you know, corporate law firms, whatever. They dream up these schemes and these new experiments, and it's the native peoples that have to live with them. And I wish there would be, you know, some way that the people who have a part in this would also have to suffer and pay the price that they impose on the rest of us. So, as you can tell, I'm very angry about these people that do all this social engineering, and that the rest of us then have to clean up the mess afterwards. And I think you ought to keep track of who all those social engineers were, and whenever you decide you want to do something, make them pay. By that I mean, I'm real serious about this. Make them retract their statements, as Pierre Trudeau recently did, for whatever his reasons. And I think it's extremely important that you got a that the natives and whoever it was prevailed, and he saw the light. So you can see, with the politicians, you can certainly bring about the pressures to change. So, you know, keep track of those people, ask them for contributions, and help them rectify the injustices that they have wrought on the people here. This will be a little disjointed because there are many thoughts, but I want to get this into the record. Someone brought up this idea of taxation. I feel, and I'm sure that many Native peoples would feel this, that the millions of acres that we have ceded away can never be repaid in terms of the taxes. Why is the U.S. so wealthy? They're wealthy because they have, the government and then the private individuals have developed and built the wealth on the land and the resources that have been taken away from Native peoples. And we need to keep this in mind. Now, I know there are all kinds of legal reasons, and I pay my taxes too. You know, I pay my income tax and my federal tax and so on. But I think the idea that Indians have already paid their taxes forever needs to be kept in mind, okay? Another thought, when we were working to achieve our restoration, we wanted maximum tribal sovereignty. And again, I want you to study the trust and management agreement that we came up with. We're the only tribe at this point, according to my understanding, and again, you have to remember now, I have not been actively involved in tribal affairs for a number of years. We're the only tribe that has the power to and the right to negotiate directly with the Secretary of the Interior. And I think that this should be looked at, both for its advantages and its disadvantages. We wanted federal protection, not federal domination. And of course, this is open to interpretations, but that was the most concise phrase that we could come up with as we worked to redefine our relationship with the federal government. Here in Alaska, the Native peoples have a high degree of political power and economic power. And I feel that this needs to really be analyzed, explored, and utilized. Politicians respond to pressure. And with the upcoming elections that are coming soon, the Native peoples need to develop their particular platform, whatever it is, and confront the congressperson, I know you have one, the two senators, and other people that are involved in the political process, and to utilize the voting power and other political and economic power that is available under this system of government. If a small tribe like the Menominees can achieve what we did in the time that we did it, with very little money and with excellent legal assistance, and we don't have the percentage of people in our state as you all do here, you can do what you want to do. Of course, you have to figure out what you want to do, and I feel that it's clear that people do want to maintain the land. They want to maintain the resources. I think people here have been very eloquent in expressing what the aspirations are. Now, there may be different ways in achieving this, but again, I look at 1991 as this huge pressure coming down, and that people do have to get mobilized.